Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Wednesday, January 2nd. I'm Ray Graff. Are home improvement projects part of your New Year's resolutions? Well, if so, you are in luck, because licensed professional engineer and construction specialist Darren Tracy is here in the studio to answer your home maintenance and repair questions. Darren Tracy has extensive experience in construction, renovation, and property management, and joins us to offer you his expertise. This is always a popular show. I advise you to call in early. The number is 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551, or you can email a brief question to voxpop@wamc.org, voxpop@wamc.org. But again, the number, 800-348-2551, Darren Tracy, Home Improvement, right after the news. Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. We talk home maintenance, repair, and improvement today, and we welcome back Darren Tracy. He is a licensed professional engineer with extensive experience in construction, renovation, and property management. Darren is a Building Performance Institute certified building analyst and a licensed master plumber. He runs the West Branch Engineering Consulting and Construction Firm, which specializes in unique projects, and he is a director of the Capital District Chapter of New York State Society of Professional Engineers. If you want to join today's discussion, give us a call, 800-348-2551. Again, that's 1-800-348-2551, or you may email us at voxpop@wamc.org. But again, the number is 800-348-2551. Darren Tracy, Happy New Year. Welcome back.
Thank you, Ray.
You brought an extension cord. What's that all about?
Well, it's a show and tell.
All right. Here on radio.
For a radio program.
Perfect.
So I'll hold it up. Can everybody
well,
see
Well, you
it?
Know, we do have the online cam at WAMC.org if you want to see that. But it's okay. Looks like just a standard two-prong extension cord.
Right. It looks like an average brown-colored extension cord you would use to plug in whatever appliance that doesn't reach your outlet.
Sure.
So just as a matter of public safety, I'd like to voice my concern about using extension cords, particularly with small portable heaters. And often you hear about fires in the winter, and often they're caused by using extension cords with portable heaters.
Mm-hmm.
And you just have to be really careful. And I will explain generally why they can be a problem. In a residential home, the wires in your home are sized paired with a circuit breaker. For instance, a 12-gauge wire is paired with a 20-amp circuit breaker,
mm-hmm.
so that if more current is drawn than that wire can handle, that circuit breaker will trip and the wire won't overheat and cause fire. What happens with an extension cord is that you don't know what gauge the wire is. So you may plug a unit heater in to this cord that draws more than the amperage that this particular extension cord is capable of handling. I'm looking on this, and this is 13 amps. It said that this cord is adequate for carrying 13 amps. Well,
yep.
That's really not a lot of wattage. According to Ohm's law, which is volt amps equals watts, the voltage times the amperage equals the number of watts. So this is 13 watts, and most homes have 115 or 120 volts. I just did the math here before the show. 120 times 13 is 1,560 watts.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a lot of watts. Some of these small unit heaters by themselves can draw 1,500 watts, 2,000 watts. And if you're on a circuit that's rated at 20 amps or 15 amps, this wire can melt before that circuit breaker will trip.
Okay.
And so that is the danger of extension cords. They're not protected adequately by the circuit breaker.
All right. So. All right. Well, that's good advice.
Okay.
And you wanted to mention something else before we start taking calls.
Well, I was. I'll make it short. I see some calls are coming in.
True
I just
enough.
Wanted to mention that trades are always a career option. Not everybody is cut out for college, particularly when they're 18 years old. I know that I wasn't.
Yeah.
It's the last thing that I wanted to do. And you can be proud of some of the work that you accomplish with your hands. It can be good pay. You can become a business owner.
Yep.
There are many businesses out there that are looking for good workers, and the owners may be towards retirement. I'm thinking of myself, and they want somebody that they could pass the business along to. So you think, well, I'm just starting a low guy in the totem pole, working my hands as a laborer or whatever. You know, it's not unheard of to work your way up and become a business owner.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to mention that.
That's
too.
Great advice. And there are ways to make a really good living, even if you're not, college is not for
right.
you. That's a
good
advice. Darren Tracy is our guest. And the number is 800-348-2551. And as Darren mentioned, the lines are beginning to load up here. There are a few open lines. Let's go right to the phones. And Linda in Troy, you're first. Hi, Linda.
Oh, hi. Hi. Oh, wow, I'm first. That's great. I think I spoke to you before. I'm restoring this Victorian, this three-story Victorian in Troy. And there are tin ceilings all throughout it. Some are in good shape and some are different. They all have different, you know, idiosyncrasies, what's going on with them. But right now I've been working in this one room, the living room, and the paint is peeling off the tin ceiling. And so I can't paint over the top of it until I get it all off or whatever. And this is it's probably oil-based paint because it chips off like little chips. It's not rubbery at all. So I tap it with the scraper, and it comes down. Some comes down, some will spill it here. And I go away and come back a couple of days, and then there's some more loose, and I tap. But at this rate, I'm not going to live, you know, probably 50 years of this chipping away to get it ready to paint. So I was just looking online, and I was thinking, well, maybe I'll try some of that Easy Off oven cleaner. Some people are saying that that's working good, and I just wondered if you had any experience with tin ceilings getting this paint off.
Okay.
No, I've never heard of using Easy Off oven cleaner on ceilings, although I've cleaned mm-hmm. my fair share of ovens with Easy Off, and it works pretty good for that.
All right.
What I would do is use a wire brush, possibly, a very soft.
That doesn't do anything.
Okay, well, if it doesn't do anything, then the paint is adhered fairly well. And also I want to caution you, Linda, regarding proper safety measures associated with that paint. If it's older, chances are that it could contain lead, and you do not want to be breathing that, and particularly cautious with if there happen to be young kids around, because lead can affect their growth more than it would affect adults. And you can use a dust mask and safety glasses and a HEPA vacuum to vacuum up after you're done. So I just want to mention that safety precaution. Again, if you get the bulk off of what you can with a very fine wire brush or sandpaper, I know that's quite a bit of work, and then recoat it with some paint.
If the paint is really on there, can't you just paint right over?
Right. Paint right
over. Well, it's all, you know, it's off in some areas and on in other areas.
It's like paint preparation is tedious. You just have to go over all the areas and hit the loose stuff, Linda.
Yeah.
So there's no solutions you could put on that would...
There might be, but...
I mean,
you know, I'm not familiar with that.
And products with the paper and stuff, but that's so messy.
Yeah.
I've used that on bricks outside. I mean, you got to hose it off. You can't do that in your living room with a tin ceiling.
Right. You might have that same problem with the Easy Off. Although, give it a try, and if it works, give us a call back.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks, Linda.
Okay, bye.
Bye now. Eight, imagine the fumes might be a bit much.
Yeah, that stuff is pretty nasty.
Yeah. Be well ventilated. Our number here is 800-348-2551. Darren Tracy is our guest. Kathy in Seward. Kathy, you're next.
Hi. I have a few thermopane windows, and one of them, the outside pane got broken, but the inside pane is intact. How does one go about fixing that?
Typically, that unit has to be removed and taken to a glass shop, or you can just take the measurements to a glass shop, and they will order up a thermal pane from a manufacturer and have it delivered probably within a week or 2 weeks. And those are filled with a gas, typically argon. And the reason they fill them with a gas instead of air is that it's more viscous and heavier, and you don't get a little current, air currents flowing inside. So that's why they have to manufacture those and make a tight seal.
So once one side is broken, you got to have the whole thing redone.
You do for top performance.
Okay, thank you.
You bet.
Thanks, Kathy. Our number here, 800-348-2551. It's Vox Pop, and we talk home improvement, maintenance, repair today with Darren Tracy. And we'll get one more in here before the first break. Martin in Colony. Martin, you're on.
Hi. I have a quick question about installing a radiator. I have a unfinished basement that has no heat, and my and I was wondering how much it would cost possibly to hook one up to a to one of my gas lines and, you know, have it heat the basement. Like a rough estimate.
When you say hook it up to your gas line, typically a radiator is associated with a hot water heating system. So are you saying, Martin, that you have a hot water heating system and it's fired by gas?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Well, in general terms, that would cost maybe 4 hours of labor.
Yeah.
For an accomplished plumber, and plumbers aren't inexpensive. You know, any place between $50 and $100 an hour, depending upon where you live.
Mm-hmm.
So you can do the math on that. It might even be longer. One thing I would caution you with a radiator is to test it before it's installed. You can pressure test that, and it's better to test it before you get it.
Check for leaks?
Check for leaks. Right.
Okay.
New ones are very expensive, and you can pick up used ones, but again, you'd want to pressure test those or before you install them, or have some sort of warranty from the supplier that they have been pressure tested. And they can be found at architectural resource stores, and, you know, they're great.
Okay.
I installed one in my office.
Oh, okay. And by expensive, is there like a certain price range?
You can, we do a lot of restoration work, so we salvage radiators, and surplus ones we sell, typically $100 for a radiator.
Bad.
And if you wanted to buy that new, it's $1,500, $2,000, something like that. So you can buy them secondhand, 10 cents on the dollar.
Well, Martin, thanks for the call. We have to take a break here, and our guest today is Darren Tracy. It's Vox Pop. The number is 800-348-2551. We'll be back. Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff with you at 800-348-2551. It's our first show of the new year. Darren Tracy is our guest, and we talk home maintenance, repair, and improvement today. And Darren, this one came in via email from Wendy. And Wendy writes, how can you determine if there is asbestos in popcorn ceilings? I'd like to have it removed, but don't know if it would contain asbestos.
Well, you have to take that to a testing lab. And you could scrape off a little piece yourself and take it to a testing lab. It's fairly common for popcorn ceiling material to contain asbestos.
Okay, so better to check it. All right, right. Our number here is 800-348-2551. And Norm in Clifton Park. Norm.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good.
Good. I just had a comment about the promotion of trades instead of going to college.
Yeah.
And I went to school. I have a degree in history. But when I was in school, I took a job as a cook. And I learned how to be, basically, I was every bit as effective as most chefs I know. I ended up being director of dining services at a college for 40 years.
Hmm.
You can do both, is what I'm saying.
That's a good idea.
I learned in the last couple of days that, you know, if you don't have to go to a four-year school, and you don't, because one is strategy and one is tactic. And I think it's important that people, as they go through their education process and their growing process, keep in mind not just what you can learn, but what are you good at and what do you enjoy?
Yeah.
And you play all, or otherwise you go out with just one club in your bag, and that can limit your opportunities.
Boy,
so I think both is effective, and I encourage students to do that all the time.
Especially if that club is not a good fit for your swing.
Yeah.
That's right. Or a club is something that you're maybe not, you know, nothing against dads because I'm a good one, but just because your dad was or is doesn't mean that necessarily the club you can hit.
Right. You make a point.
Anyway.
Norm, thanks a lot for the call. Our number here is 800-348-2551. It's Vox Pop, home maintenance, repair, and improvement today. Darren Tracy is the guest, and we go to our old buddy Jim in North Pownell. Hello, Jim.
Hi, Ray. Hi, Darren. I got to weigh in on two things. One of them is the extension cord thing. People should not use those little light gauge extension cords for heaters at all, period. If you're going to use an extension cord for a heater, make sure it's a three-pronger. Make sure it's at least a 14-gauge cord and not very long.
Right, and 14-gauge might not even work. If you're on a 20-amp circuit, you could draw more with the more on that 14-gauge wire than
it can handle.
Yeah,
you know, most of your houses, you're going to be using a 15-amp circuit, and a 14-gauge will handle that with no problem without burning out, and it'll trip the breaker. You got to know your breaker panel, and you've got to know, you know, what you're dealing with as far as what it's going to draw.
Right. That's really good advice, and I'm glad you called in to mention that. Just as a rule, don't use an extension cord at all with a unit heater, small little portable heater.
And another thing on the ceiling stripper, the stuff to take the paint off of the tin ceiling, you got to be really, really careful, because if it's a tin ceiling, it's probably got lead paint on it, and you don't want to mess with it dry. You got to work it wet, because lead paint gets into the air, and you breathe it in, and it shortens your lifespan.
Yeah, Darren mentioned that. Okay. Yeah, that's a good point. Hey, Jim, Happy New Year, buddy.
Happy New Year to you, Ray. I got another package coming to you in the mail.
I saw this stuff.
You poor guy.
That's all right, man. I saw the stuff you sent last time. Thanks a lot. Let's go on over to James in Hudson. James, you're on.
Hi, taking off speaker. Yeah, it's the same thing about the tin ceiling thing.
Yeah.
I'm a fine art painter, but you got to do a lot of other jobs if you're going to be a fine artist. And yeah, some of those peel and strip things would be good because it will contain the paint. Don't use heat because that will send all those toxic chemicals out into your lungs. And don't just wear a regular dust mask. You need one with a ventilator. And and there's some good products on the market, like some good just sealers. Like, I'm not going to use, but there are two. They both have one word names.
Okay.
And they're very good. And maybe that would be the best way to go. Just get the loose paint and then do a really good prime job and then paint over that. I think that's probably the safest way to go.
All right, James. Thank you. You agree with that, Darren?
I do, with one caveat on the respirator. He mentioned a dust mask and a respirator. I do not think you need a bona fide respirator that's form-fitting on your face. I think you should have a dust mask that is rated for lead paint removal, and it's a little bit more than the low-end dust mask, but I think that is adequate.
Okay.
According to the Department of Health. In fact, with a full-blown respirator, those should be fit properly, or those can cause breathing problems.
All right, let's go over to Arlana in Oneonta. You're on.
Hi. So I own a very old, well, a pretty old house. It's 99 years old here in Oneonta, and I am pretty sure that some of the electrical wiring in the house is the original wiring. So sometimes when I use the newer light bulbs, the LEDs and the newer constructed ones, they start to flicker pretty badly in these the sockets. And I'm wondering, one, if that is dangerous. I assume it probably is. And two, what can I do about it?
Okay, yeah, that's not a good thing to have a light bulb or any switch or receptacle flickering or if you hear a buzz, that signals that there's some arcing going on, and arcing creates heat, and that can cause a fire. So that's not a good thing, and that should be looked into. I'm surprised that just LED bulbs have that problem. It sounds like there might be something loose in the socket itself, so I would replace the socket, have that checked out, make sure your circuits are properly protected with circuit breakers or the old fuses, and make sure the fuse size is paired properly with a wire. That's key. A 14-gauge wire needs to be protected by a 15-amp fuse. A 12-gauge wire can go up to a 20-amp.
Okay, it's just recently with the newer light bulbs that the flickering has been. You know, I've been in the house now for almost 4 years, and originally when I was just using the old-style light bulbs, there was no problem at all. But once I started putting in the newer light bulbs, they were flickering and buzzing. Yeah, I took them out. I didn't use it because it sounded unsafe.
Yeah, so that's not a problem I'm familiar with. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
But anyway, flickering, I'd have that checked out by a qualified electrician.
All right. Well, thank you for the call. Our number is 800-348-2551. It's Vox Pop on WAMC, and Darren Tracy is our guest today. Kelsey in Voorheesville. Kelsey, you're on.
Hi there.
Hi.
Hi there. So I just had a quick question. So I'm currently pregnant right now with our second child. We're getting ready to move our first child into the spare bedroom. We live in a raised ranch, though, so that spare bedroom is above the garage. And we didn't notice until right when we were getting ready to move him in that room is about 10 degrees colder than the rest of the house. So we've been trying to come up with solutions because our older son will only be 2 when he moves in there to get it to warm up. One of the things we came up with was doing spray foam insulation in the garage. The other would be to replace the garage door entirely. We didn't know if either of those would have a huge impact or if we have to do them both together at the same time.
You do not have to do the both together at the same time. So the bedroom is above the garage?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, you could insulate, we have an office above our garage, and when we built that, we were made sure to insulate the ceiling of the garage to insulate the space above, and it sounds like that wasn't done. One thing you could do would be to install a rigid foam board insulation on the ceiling of your garage, and then you'd put sheetrock over top of that, or you could remove the existing sheetrock and insulate those bays with fiberglass. I know that sounds like a lot of work. You could make sure that your weather stripping on your existing door is tight, and that's a good seal, and that would be the least expensive option to try. But that's a problem. You really do need to insulate the floor of the bedroom above, which would also be the garage ceiling. I could talk to you about that more offline, too.
Go ahead, Kelsey.
Yeah, that would be great.
Okay. Well, your Darren's email address is?
It's darren@westbranchinc.com, D-A-R-R-E-N at WESTBRANCHINC.com. Yeah, you can contact me after, and I can discuss some of those details a little bit more because you might be able to save yourself some work.
Oh, that's nice. All right, our number here is 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. Joyce called earlier, got dropped, and has been waiting a while. Joyce, you're on.
Yes, my foundation in the basement is crumbling. I live in a 100-year-old house. And I'm looking for some answers to have it repaired and a reason and some price range to work with.
Okay. Is it a stone foundation, Joyce?
It's stone, but it's been, it's been mixed. It's an old house, so it's been mixed with material that rots is the problem. It's not an uncommon problem in my neighborhood.
Okay. All right. What I suggest you do is repoint the joints in between the stone, or if it's patched in with brick, between the stone and the brick?
It's just crumbling. There's no brick involved.
I
don't know what the material is, but I can pick away at it with my fingers, and it crumbles and falls on the cellar floor.
Okay, that's what you have to repair, and it's called repointing. It would be the joints in between the rocks. You repoint the mortar. You chip those out with a chisel or a repointing hammer, and you mix up some mortar. And actually, a homeowner can do this. It takes a little bit of practice to bring yourself up to speed with a learning curve. But you need to repoint those joints. You just chip the mortar out in between the rocks or bricks. And if there aren't, if the bricks are disintegrated, you've got to patch that in with some other material.
No bricks, all rocks.
Okay, it's all rocks. Okay, the rocks are fairly hard, so you can use a harder mortar, like a Type N or a Type S mortar, masonry cement, and you can buy that in a bag pre-mixed with sand, lime, and cement, and just add water, and you're good to go.
I'm trying to write this all down. Motor bag, what?
It's called a prepackaged masonry cement, and you can get that at your hardware store or big box store.
Okay.
And it's made for patching mortar joints. And again, it's relatively easy to do. It's just somewhat time consuming.
And Joyce, I should let you know that the audio of this program will be available about 15 minutes after we're done with the show. And it's at WAMC.org. And you can roll that section back as many times as you want and take notes. Thanks for the call. We appreciate it. Darren Tracy is our guest. It's Vox Pop on WAMC. Jim in Rensselaer. Jim, you're on.
Oh, good afternoon and Happy New Year.
You too.
I'm thinking of replacing a gas-fired boiler. I believe it's from the 70s. That it exhausts through a 12-inch diameter vent into the chimney through its own separate flue. And people replacing it, supposedly, say it has to vent through something like a 4 or 6 inch pipe, and it can't be, the original 12 inch vent can't be used. They say they can vent it straight into the second flue of the chimney, and it does not need any, you know, stainless steel liner up the chimney. As far as I know, the chimney is, got tile on the inside. I'm not sure if the moisture would mess things up. They say I don't need it. I don't know if I do.
Okay, it depends on if it's a high-efficiency unit or not. I think the reason that they want the diameter decreased is so that the flue gases remain at a higher temperature and don't condense. Cool off and condense, because when warm air cools, warm air can hold more moisture than cold air, and then as that air moves up the chimney, it cools off and can condense. So I would say that's the reason that they're suggesting that. Some of these high-efficiency units you can directly out your basement wall with PVC piping. The flue gases are at a much lower temperature. So
they're talking about an 85-87% efficient boiler.
Right. Again, I think that's the reason why they're suggesting to go with a smaller diameter, because of the condensation problem.
All right, Jim. Good luck with that. We appreciate the call, and we go to Joanne in Kingston. Joanne.
Yeah, hi. I had a tin ceiling that was It kind of weathered a bit and somehow inside the house, and it formed these little triangle sticking down into the room. And I just put up with that as long as I could. And then I put on a good aspirator and knocked those all down. There were, I don't know, maybe 400 or 500 of the darn things. And you got to be careful when you sweep. I sealed off the other rooms with plastic, so the dust didn't go anywhere, and had to discard that appropriately of the chips. And then I fingered all those chips with a silicone sealer. And so that took a while. And after that, I just rolled the ceiling with a new paint, and given that there was a pattern on the ceiling, He couldn't see any problem whatsoever, especially since I had made that little chip distance into a little triangle there, you know, and flattened it down, smoothed it down. It was great. It lasted for about 22 years or so, and then other pieces started coming down. Those are probably pieces that had not previously come down.
Hmm.
And,
okay.
You know,
well, I'm glad that worked out.
And I did the same thing. Done.
I'm glad that worked out for you, Joanne. And I'm
But it just took a lot of handiwork, you know, fingering all of those carefully.
I'm also glad that
it worked. So I don't know what the woman's problem was with her. She never stated.
Yeah. Go ahead, Darren.
Okay.
You want to say something?
She had a problem with the
I wanted to say that I'm also glad that you called in and mentioned putting up plastic, because that's another measure that should be taken when dealing with lead. Isolate the particular area that you are working in, and that minimizes the impact throughout the house. So I appreciate you calling in and mentioning that.
Well, Joanne, we have to take a quick break here. Darren Tracy is our guest. It's Home Maintenance, Repair, and Improvement today on Vox Pop. 800-348-2551 is the number. We'll be right back. Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff with you on a Wednesday, and Darren Tracy is our guest here on the first Vox Pop of the new year. A few emails here, Darren, and then we will get back to the phones. You have an email there you want to share?
Well, you can read that if you'd like.
All right. This one says, "Hi, Dad. How is it possible that underground church structures carved out of a single rock, both inside and out from a single rock 900 years ago, are still in operation today?" That's from your daughter.
It's from her daughter. She is over in Africa on a kind of a meditation and vacation thing. Anyways, hi, Devin. Thanks for listening to the show. And I'd say the main reason that that has survived is because of the climate. It's in a warmer climate, and you don't get the freeze-thaw cycles that you would have here in the northern hemisphere. And that's why that's able to survive. It's probably arid as well, so you don't have a lot of water around there.
All right. Well, this one came in from Jay. Can you discuss the most efficient hot water delivery with an existing oil furnace, and could you include solar-powered hot water heater?
Yes, you can include a solar-powered hot water heater. It'd be a separate loop that's tied in, thermostatically controlled. most efficient... probably natural gas fired. It would be the most efficient and least costly method of heating up the hot water if you're fortunate enough to live where there is natural gas.
Mm-hmm. This one's from Jeremy. And Jeremy lives in an 1896 Victorian in Great Barrington, Massachusetts. And the bottom line here, it's a fairly long paragraph, but a lot of projects. And Jeremy's trying to find and establish a relationship with a reliable contractor engineer and having a devil of a time, and that's kind of a common occurrence. Is there a place, Jeremy wants to know, where you can go, such as a licensing board or trade association in the Berkshires, where you could find a reliable contractor who has been vetted in some way? Well, we get this question fairly often.
Right. I'm not that familiar with Massachusetts, but I think generally states work similarly. Regarding engineering, it's a licensing organization in New York State. It's through the State Education Department, and I assume it would be the same in Massachusetts.
All right.
So that's what you can do for engineers. For contractors, you can check out Chamber of Commerce's.
Right.
And there are different accreditations associated with different trades, so you would want to make sure that they have an accreditation from their particular trade affiliation.
All right, and this is the last email, and then we'll go right back to the phones. This one's from Alyssa, and Alyssa says, listening over here at work in the Mohonasson School District. Well, hello, Mohonasson School District. Alyssa writes, I wanted to follow up about the comment about the circuit breaker tripping. We moved into an old church across the street from Powers Park. It's beautiful. We do, however, always manage to trip the breaker in the bathroom when blow-drying hair. Do you know why that is? Is it a serious problem? I usually just grow and reset it and go about my day, but now I'm wondering if it's something to alert my landlord about.
Yes, it is definitely something to alert your landlord about. These circuit breakers are designed to trip and shut the power off when the wire or when the circuit draws too much current for a particular wire. So I would assume that there are other appliances on that circuit drawing electricity, or maybe the circuit itself is undersized and it's a 15-amp circuit where it should be a 20-amp circuit. But that's something that definitely should be looked at. If you trip a breaker, that should be investigated, particularly if it happens more than once. It's not a good thing to keep resetting a breaker that trips for a reason. It just draws too much current for the particular circuit or that breaker, and it's a warning that there's a problem.
Okay. I mean, some of those blow dryers can really pull some wattage.
Really serious. Right. It's the same problem I was talking about with electric heater. You wouldn't want to put a blow dryer on an extension cord.
No.
Because these cords may not be properly protected by the correct breaker size.
All right. Well, Alyssa, thanks for that one. Now let's go back to the phones, and we go to Mary in Woodstock. Hello, Mary. Oh, hey, Mary. Yo, can you turn the radio down? Oh, boy, that's embarrassing. All right, she'll be getting our signal right about now. Hello, Mary. Yes, can you turn the radio down? That's what I
Should I shut it off?
Yes, that's a wonderful idea. Yes. Yes.
Okay.
Okay. Well, thank you. You're on.
I have an old double pane, very large. It's like the size of a patio window. But the nitrogen or whatever was between the two panes has failed, and it was recommended that I get a new panel. An email patio size door with a double pane.
Yeah.
Someone recommended, and by the way, that would cost about $1,000.
Yikes. Ouch.
And I would have to have my own carpenter put back the trim to hold it in the wall. But somebody recommended I should get a triple pane since it's so large, this patio glass, that it would be much, much warmer. With a triple pane, Pella.
Oh, yeah. Okay, well, triple pane would be more energy efficient than the double pane. But
yeah, what
that
about
would
a
be,
quadruple
that
pane?
That would be even more expensive than the $1,000 replacement. That's a lot of money. You may want to even...
And they added, not only would the triple pane cost more, but they would have to do some carpentry inside, because the space was originally designed for the double pane.
Right. Yeah, Mary, that's you may want to consider replacing the complete window unit. It may be more cost effective, and you can live with the unit failed. You just have that shady, obscure look in the window if you can't afford the replacement.
Okay.
Thanks,
Mary,
for calling.
Yeah, thanks for the call. We appreciate it very much. We got to move on here. We have so many calls on the line. Let's go over to Mark in Schenectady. Hello, Mark. You're on.
Hi, good afternoon. Earlier caller mentioned problems with flickering LEDs, and I had the same problem, and I was able to solve it by using a combination of dimmable and non-dimmable LEDs. The non-dimmables were the ones that were flickering, and especially with a three-way switch and a fixture with multiple bulbs, if I put one dimmable LED and the rest non-dimmable, problem went away.
Interesting.
Do you know what the explanation for that is, Mark?
I have no idea. You know, the LEDs have some sort of circuitry in them, and I think it might have to do with whatever they're getting with voltage or current coming in that's not allowing them to light totally off. But the dimmables obviously can go with you know, reduced voltage coming in, and that resolved the problem.
Okay, thank you very much.
That's a very interesting call. Thanks, Mark. Darren Tracy is our guest today on Vox Pop. It's home maintenance, repair, and improvement. The number is 800-348-2551. Jeff in South Hadley. Hello, Jeff.
Hey, thanks for taking the call. Hey, my wife and I recently purchased a house that's turned into a bit of a money pit, but the concern I'm calling about is between the garage and the house, the house foundation, everything, the walls seem to be dropping a little bit. And I discovered after moving in that there's water coming into the garage and into that area outside the house. And that I assume over the years has caused that problem of it dropping. But I'm hoping to mitigate that and want to find out what I'm looking at.
Okay, Jeff, how old is the house approximately?
So it was, it was built about 1960s. And I believe this is added on. Judging by the construction in the neighborhood, this was something, you know, that was added on, so it may not have been done with the original construction.
Okay. Well, it sounds like you have some erosion going on there since you mentioned the water, and that could be carrying some of the soils away from the bottom of the foundation and creating a void in your foundation settling. So what I would do is to direct any water away from the building that you could, and that could be done with rain gutters, and if there's any storm water that's directed downgrade towards your particular structure, I would divert that away. That's where I would start. You may also have a compaction problem, soil settlement problem, resulting in the soil being compressed over time and the house settling. Have to take a look at that a bit more closely. If you want to send me a couple of pictures,
oh, that'd be nice.
After the show, I can take a look at that more closely.
And once again, your email address, Darren?
It's darren@westbranchinc.com.
That's D-A-R-R-E-N.
Correct.
Okay, Jeff, good luck. Thanks for the call. Our number is 800-348-2551. Marcus and Fonda. Marcus, you're on.
Hey, how you doing? I have a two-part question. I was wondering, I have a stainless steel, one of those flexible flues that go up through a stone chimney, and I was wondering what I could burn through that. My second question is about a generator running an extension cord. How much power do you lose per foot or per 10 feet or so on?
Okay, the drop in the current is affected by the length. It's also affected by the diameter of the wire, and those diameters are sized in gauges. The bigger the number, the smaller the gauge. So it depends on those particular variables. Regarding the stainless steel flue, I'm not sure that the manufacturer should rate that if that's a multi-fuel flue where you can burn gas or oil or wood. So you check with the manufacturer on that.
Okay. Well, I had gas in it, so I didn't know if I could burn like a pellet stove through it or
right. It's wood like the wood is probably the most critical fuel because of the creosote that can build up deposits. And gas would be less invasive. So I would check with the manufacturer because it's not a given that you can use that as a multi-fuel flue.
All right. Thanks for the call. And now over to Andy in Albany. Andy, you're on.
Hi, guys. I have a solution, well, a possible solution anyway, to the flickering LED light.
Yeah.
I came across a house that had a very similar issue, and it turned out that the wiring was incorrectly put in, and the incandescent lights were actually in series in one room. And because as long as they were incandescent, the resistance on the bulb is much lower. It's like 4 ohms, 3.5 to 4 ohms, where LED and CFL are up quite a bit higher in resistance. So when the light was turned on, there wasn't enough voltage flowing through one bulb to get to the other bulb efficiently.
Hmm.
So it required just a little bit of rewiring to change out to make sure that every bulb was hit with parallel instead of series circuit. Hmm. And that was a quick solution to that.
Okay. Well, that's interesting. I'm going to have to research that more. That sounds a little bit odd that it was in series circuit versus parallel, because if you remove the light bulb and it was in series circuit, then everything downstream wouldn't work. So I'm not sure that it's series and parallel. It may be a polarity issue where the polarity was reversed.
All right. Well, that's something to maybe do a little research for the next show.
That, yeah.
Let's go to Veronica in Scotia. You're on.
Hi, I am calling with a question regarding our attic. We are in an old house. The attic is accessed by a full staircase, and at the top of the staircase where the floor is completely level, just the opening for the stairs, we cover it year-round with a large piece of foam insulating board. But the attic itself has two windows, and we have them open just a teeny bit through the summertime so that the attic doesn't get too hot. Last winter, they remained open through the winter, and we found that when it got bitter cold, there was condensation and frosting on the inside of the attic on the roof. And so then as it started to warm up slightly, we had water dripping down onto all the things stored in the attic. I'm wondering if we should... I believe we should probably close those windows. My husband thinks that perhaps keeping the attic cold helps keep the roof cold and allows the ice or the snow to melt off naturally rather than forming ice dams and issues that way.
Okay. Well, there's quite a bit of information.
The roof does seem to have a peak vent.
Okay. There's quite a bit of information there to comment on. I would agree with your husband that you should leave the attic windows open.
Okay.
I would disagree that it helps melt the snow more off the roof. The reason for keeping the attic cool or open and cool is so you're not actually melting snow on your roof.
So it doesn't.
Right. And the other reason...
It melts naturally with the sun.
The other reason, Veronica, is that you will have warm air migrating up through your ceiling into the atmosphere. And as I explained earlier in the program, warm air can hold a lot more moisture than cold air.
Yeah.
And when it cools off, that warm air cools off, that moisture condenses out. As you would breathe your warm breath on a mirror in the bathroom, and it would fog up. That's a physical principle. So that happens in your attic, and that's not good. You get that moisture up there, and then you can get mold, and the wood can start to rot. So what you want to do is you want to vent that as much as possible. It's a little bit puzzling that you noticed more moisture with the windows being open and not less. It seems like there might be something else going on there.
Okay.
Yep.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. We quickly go over to Bill. Bill in Poughkeepsie, you got about 30 seconds, buddy.
Okay. Thanks for taking my call. I'll ask my question and get off because I'm on a cell phone. I'll listen to the radio answer.
Sure.
I'm thinking about putting in a whole house generator, a 10K kilowatt, 11 kilowatt generator. The placement of it, I would like to put it at one end of the house out of the way. Unfortunately, the panel is probably 90 feet away. A, is that possible? And I heard your prior question about voltage or current drop over distance. And then any recommendations on how that might be done?
All right.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Bill.
Okay. Yeah, I think you could put that 90 feet away. It's quite a ways. And you could combat the resistance loss by increasing the wire size. But I think that can be done, yes.
All right. Well, Darren Tracy, we're just about out of time here. Once again, if people want to get in touch with you.
Darren at westbranchinc.com is my email. And also you can search my website. It's westbranchengineering.com. Also have a construction business, westbranchinc.com. You type in West Branch Engineering or West Branch Construction in your Google or Safari search bar, and I'll be there.
All right, Darren, Tracy, thank you. And once again, Happy New Year. Support comes from Agricultural Stewardship Association, helping people conserve farmland in the Upper Hudson Valley. We conserve good farmland for good forever. agstewardship.org. Penny Farthing, a socially responsible investment management personal retirement and endowment portfolio. Amherst, pennyfarthinginvestment.com. Eric Bright, CFA. And the Waldorf School of Saratoga Springs, giving children the education on tools for the challenges of an ever-changing world. WaldorfSaratoga.org. Thanks again to Darren Tracy for stopping by today. Thank you for listening. Thank you for remembering to turn your radio down when you're on the air. That's always a good thing. Just jot that down for the next time. And thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Your phones were answered by Kayleen White, and only briefly. And then Amber Sickles came, and she handled the calls, and really, with aplomb. Well done. Our producer is Jim Lavoulis. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, Bob Berman swoops in for another astronomy edition of the program. Right now, stand by for news.